Okay, well, that makes more sense, and a little bit more what I was in line thinking. And because my antenna was basically a half wave on 20 meters, which is the band we were trying to compare them on, and he had a quarter wave vertical, I think he had a one long radial ground plane on it, plus the, it was attached to a cyclone fence. I was thinking that mine was going to be more efficient because mine is, doesn't need the ground. You know, it's a half wave, it's set at the end, and where his needs that ground. But interesting. I wonder where this one will do some more testing. We did just use the antenna switch, flip back and forth, and there was the ever so slightest increase in noise on one of them, but they, you certainly couldn't say, well, that antenna's better than this one, at least not under those conditions. So, I thank you for the information, Dick. Always good as always. KTUPS Mobile.
You just got into another very good factor of efficiency that I wasn't including earlier, Rich. When you end feed a piece of wire that's roughly a half wavelength long, where the input impedance you see is something like 1,000 ohms or 1,500 ohms for the resistive component, at first you think you put yourself into a huge difficulty because whether or not the antenna tuner can find it and click away and find the right solution, whether or not you've got to add an auxiliary L network in order to get the impedance matching, at first an end-fed 1,000 or 1,500 impedance looks like a disadvantage. You're onto something here, Rich. It can be a huge advantage. When you're end-feeding a 1,000-ohm load, how good is your counterpoise now becomes extremely slight. In other words, as long as your vehicle as a counterpoise acts like something fairly small to ground compared to 1,000 ohms, you've automatically got a good counterpoise without hooking up a piece of wire to the fence. So when it comes to portable operations, an end-fed wire has this huge advantage. A simple stake in the ground, even if you don't have the vehicle nearby, can be more than enough counterpoise. Let me drop. If that stake in the ground presented a 150-ohm resistive impedance to the rest of the world, and you're feeding a 1,000-ohm antenna, 90-some-odd percent of your voltage is going to the antenna, and that counterpoise is good enough. You take that same stake in the ground with a 150-ohm resistive component, and feed the bottom of a quarter wave ground plane where it's 35 ohm impedance. All your voltage is going into that 150 ohms to ground, and very little is going into the antenna. You've got a lousy impedance ratio there with a quarter wave. Everyone thinks the quarter wave ground plane is the best possible antenna. Once you understand the real physics of what's going on, once you jump over the apparent difficulty of feeding 1,000 or 1,500 ohms, there's a huge in-the-field advantage. Almost anything is a counterpoise when you're feeding a 1,000-ohm impedance, an end-fed antenna, Rich. You're on the right track, and you've got the higher impedance, you've got the higher radiation efficiency because you're putting less of that energy into Mother Earth because your ground plane, your counterpoise doesn't have to be that good anymore because your antenna is such a high impedance. You see what's going on here? You're way ahead of the game, in my opinion, Rich. KTUPS, KQLIW in the TechNet.
KTUPN. Oh, I've been sold on the insets for a while. I mean, I see how well they work for me. So, and when I think it was last summer, when I got Japan with 5 watts on, I think that was 17 meters, about 6 o'clock in the evening. That was the best I had done, and that was really cool. But for the low angle of radiation and not having to worry about deploying so much of the ground under it really helps, and just the ease of use to put it up and be able to change bands and stuff. I'm very happy with the results I've got. I've had a lot of people tell me, "Oh, that antenna isn't efficient; it's not going to work." So, well, you know, I've got hundreds of contacts in the log that prove otherwise, so it works for me. So, thanks to KTUPN.
Keep up the good work, Rich. You're on the right track. You're going to get flack from people because you're a little bit left of center what the average guy is doing. And they're going to give you discouraging sounding words that it can't possibly be efficient. You're not doing it the way everyone else is doing it. You can't be right. You're right. Stick to your guns. I think we've gone down the list of people who signed in. And I know that last week we skipped over the mailbags. You must be piling up mailbag questions there, WGB. Mr. Mailbag, KQLIW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
Good evening, Dick, and everybody on the net. Well, yeah, I have some left over from last week, but this week was really slow. I guess everybody's prepping for the Super Bowl. But I have a couple here, so let me get started. I'll let it drop. All right, I have a young gentleman here who is building some equipment, and he needs capacitors that are wind better than 1% match. And he has an oscilloscope, he has a generator, and he has a voltmeter. And that's about the list of his equipment. What is the best way, or what kind of circuit, or what can he do firm that capacitors are within better than 1%? Maybe you've got a trick for him. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, that's a real tough one, John. If I had good laboratory instrumentation in current calibration, like the stuff on Staten Island that you know about, where big bucks are being paid for calibrating, and I wanted to guarantee 1% accuracy of measuring capacitors, that is a tall order. And your chances of success of really getting to the nearest 1% are not good. I'd like to go back to the base of the situation in the first place. Just because somebody wrote an article saying the capacitors you use here better have 1% accuracy, the fact that they wrote that, yeah, it relieves him of the liability of somebody saying, gee, I followed your article, it doesn't work, and then that person who wrote the 1% command can say, well, you didn't follow my advice, you didn't use 1% capacitors, therefore I can't guarantee the results. The guy's got a great protection, but it's not fair. Very rarely do you need that kind of accuracy. And if you do, a particular location, let me drop it. Particular location, for some reason, like your nulling signals, needs that kind of accuracy. You're going to put a 75% fixed capacitor and a 50% variable capacitor in parallel, and now you're going to vary the capacitor until you get the null, if you know what I mean. There's ways around that. When it comes to measuring capacitors of unknown size, in other words, somebody has wiped off the markings on the capacitor and you don't know what they are, there are ways you can take a 6.3-volt filament transformer at 60 hertz, feed a signal through the capacitor into your digital voltmeter, and on the assumption you really know the impedance of your digital voltmeter, and you measure the amount of voltage at 60 hertz that comes out the other end. With the right kind of smarts, you can measure capacitors as small as 10 picofarad and as large as 1,000 picofarad or more with that technique. But you're not going to get 1% accuracy out of it. So there are simple techniques by which you can confirm the approximate value of a capacitor. But 1% is really tough. And if you pay big bucks and you buy the right capacitor from the right manufacturer, and on the case it says plus or minus 1%, most likely you're getting that, but you're going to have to pay for it. Other than that, establishing that kind of traceable to the bureau accuracy, in my opinion, is pretty tough for Rich. John, KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, there, John.
Eric, let's see how you do it. You're traceable to the Bureau with most of your broadcast instrumentation. Let's see how you do it, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW. Make it simple if it's possible.
Yeah, I can use it to go. And a high rise time, a very quick rise time oscillator. And I just measure the voltage. It's 6.6% calculated based upon the frequency and got the capacitance. And it's as accurate as the voltage measurement in your scope.
Do you have a gut feel, Eric, that you could get 1% accuracy out of that overall procedure you just described?
No, if I'm using a newfangled, calibrated, Tektronix scope, I know I can get close. But, as with everything, there's variables. But one application of 1% accuracy, back to your fixed audio oscillators, like Peptone pads, that'd be pretty close.
Yeah, quite often there's a step-by-step procedure in which you can establish the real capacitance, put it across a known inductor, measure the resonant frequency. calculate the amount of shift in oscillating and resonant frequency. So there's various ways by step where you can compare it to known good capacitors, known good inductors, known good frequency measuring equipment. There's various ways it can be done, but still 1% is tough. The National Bureau of Standards, as it used to be called, NIST now, National Institute of Science and Technology, they can do that, but they got to go through hell to get that kind of accuracy, in my opinion. And so what's your guess, John, as to is there really that much need for this particular possibly homebrew circuit? There aren't very many circuits which really need that kind of accuracy, as long as you're willing to do some tuning and tweaking. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, don't forget, Dick, it's a question of matching them, not so much the exact value, but Eric brought up a very good possibility. I'd like to know if he thinks it's possible to use that method on the scope, not even have to go through the calculations, but use it as a go-no-go gauge to see if they're similar enough. It doesn't matter if it's like a 0015, but if they're both that level, I think his match would be sufficient for what he's doing. What do you think?
Can I make any comment without getting kicked in the head?
As I see it, John, I missed your original statement. Making a matched pair, that's very different. Oh, yes. Now there's a lot of techniques by which you can make a matched pair. I thought you wanted absolute accuracy of 1%. Building matched pairs, any of these techniques can confirm something like 1% matched pair accuracy. Let's see what Eric says about that. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
Steve, I can throw a comment in before I get kicked in the head. I could help you guys out.
Oh, I'll tell you this much. As far as matching a unknown capacitor, today's scopes, you can put up the little lines as to what the waveform looks like, where the start and the descent point of the capacitor that you're measuring is. You get those lines up on the screen, you pop in the next capacitor. Depending upon, the sweep range of the scope, it can get pretty damn close. I'll give you that. There are other things involved in terms of temperature, bleed lengths, on all this stuff, depending upon, again, the value of the capacitor, what the frequency is. But, yeah, I could see setting that up. Well, either way, you guys may not be aware, but on YouTube, there's my friend W2AW has a whole series of measurement types, very, very informative, and that's also one of the things that he touches on. So, if you're interested, have a look on YouTube, W2AW, and you'll find like 200 little string events of various different forms of measurements and stuff like that.
How did you first become aware of W2AW? Is he somebody you've worked with in the past, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, for many, many years, he's my Tektronix salesman.
Yeah, I recognize those call letters, AW. And why am I not thinking of who that is? Sure enough, North Jersey Contest Club is what W2AW is listed as right now. What's the name of the man that used to be your Tektronix representative, Eric? Go ahead.
I don't know if you got the calls right. It's Whiskey 2, Alpha Edward Williams.
You're right. I looked up AW, not Alpha Edward Williams. Alan Folk. I'm trying to remember. Yes, I think I recognize him. Good guy. So, you've been dealing with him for a lot of years. Is that true, Eric?
Yes, very smart man. You should, let's go to YouTube and type in his call sign. Have a look at some of his videos.
Good information, Eric, and thank you for that. So, John, I wasn't listening carefully enough, and I didn't realize you needed matched pairs with 1%. I thought you wanted absolute accuracy of 1%, which is 50 times more tough. So, matched pairs, there's various ways you can put two capacitors on two arms of a Wheatstone bridge and force them to give you a null that's going to be really exact at your operating frequency, depending on the quality of your other two resistors in that Wheatstone bridge. So there's lots of ways of doing this. Tuning for a no, as you do with a Wheatstone bridge, can be an extremely precise way of tuning for something. Tuning for a peak on, say, a Viswa test, finding the peak is pretty broad. Finding the null is sharp as all hell. So when you were making a length of transmission line measurements in your laboratory, and you were using the nulling locations in millimeters on your slotted line, I bet you found a hell of a lot more accuracy with the results. Isn't that true, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, absolutely. And there is a difference in looking at the null situation. It is much sharper than looking at the peaks. Now they're basically the same shape, but you do find a difference when you're looking for the null. It is a much sharper and a more defined area on the delay on the slotted line. You're absolutely right.
So, John, if you think we've almost answered that question, you're allowed to go to the next one. Go right ahead, John.
Very good. I think he'll be happy with that. That's a great idea that Eric came up with there. That's perfect for a situation. He's trying to prevent assembling it and then try, tap on a few puffs here and there. He doesn't want to do that. He'd like to use just match capacitors, so I'm sure he's got his answer. Okay, let me know, drop, and I'll go on to this next question, which you have spoke about many times. All right, this young gentleman has heard discussions on interferometry, and he would like to know basically what it is, and why is it used, and what do they gain by using it? He has heard a few conversations, but evidently not enough to elevate his understanding. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
If you Google the word RF interferometry, I'm pretty sure you're going to find quite a number of articles. And if you use my method of explaining where does an antenna pattern come from, and you explain it by taking little chunks of the antenna and just figuring out what that chunk of the antenna is radiating, amplitude and phase angle, and look at the various chunks being used simultaneously as an interferometer, you will build the antenna pattern on that paper. You go and measure it, you say, aha, that's it. Let's discuss a basic pair of antennas. I've got a horn antenna that maybe my horn, a standard gain horn, I don't know the exact number, maybe it's got a 30 degree beam width. And so now using that horn to listen to signals, easily within 30 degrees, I know the direction of arrival of that signal. And if I'm smart enough to wave the horn around just right, maybe I can get down to 15 degrees of accuracy of direction of arrival of a signal when receiving it on that horn. This is a microwave signal in this example. And because I've got a pair of these horns, let me drop.
Dick, by the way, he said you could explain it in optical or RF, either one you wanted to do, but you're pursuing the RF, that's fine.
Yeah, I'm going to go to the RF first. And I'm not as, probably not as good at doing it in optical, although I should be. So I now put a pair of horns, and if I put them one wavelength apart, now let's make them two wavelengths apart. Two wavelengths apart, and I now feed the two with a power divider, and now I take this pair of antennas and I wave them around. As I start off with the two horns aimed directly at the signal of arrival, both horns pick up the same signal strength at the exact same phase angle, and those two signals in my power divider add. I now rotate this array of two horns a little bit to the right, and as I do that, the left-hand horn is being moved forward, it's getting closer to the source. The right-hand horn is being moved away from the source. It's looking at lagging phase. And now those two signals might be very close to the same amplitude, but they're being combined slightly out of phase, and they're adding like a vector. And you're now starting to see a significant decrease in the overall signal strength. And you keep sweeping that pair of horns, this interferometer, and you will very rapidly find a null. And depending on the number of wavelengths between the two horns, that null could be made 5 degrees away from the bore site, or even go further to 3 degrees. So with interferometry, you can do some extremely fine tuning with finding the direction of arrival of an unknown signal. So interferometry, powerful tool in doing direction finding. Let me drop. The good news is as you extend the distance between the two horns, they call it the baseline. As I extend the baseline, the number of degrees between those nulls gets smaller and smaller. I'm getting higher and higher resolution, but I'm getting ambiguity. As you continue to sweep, as you rotate the pair of antennas that are now pretty far apart, and you rotate them far enough, pretty soon the right-hand antenna is 180 degrees delayed, the left-hand antenna is 180 degrees advanced, you've now found the second side lobe. So as you extend the spacing, as you extend your baseline, you get sharper and sharper nulls, closer and closer together, but more and more ambiguity. So now you're not sure you're on the main lobe, the first side lobe, or the second side lobe, if you know what I mean. The next step in using interferometry, and this was done by a record-breaking technique used on the SR-71, and I was involved to some degree in that project. AIL made that electronics. Let me drop. And the real smart of that direction-finding receiver was a double dual interferometer. In other words, instead of two elements of the interferometer, you had three elements. You had a main antenna, a second antenna with a small baseline spacing, a third antenna with a much larger baseline spacing, and if you're smart enough and choose the small and the large spacing, you get the sharp advantage of the large spacing. The small spacing resolves the ambiguity. You find out right away whether or not you're on the first side lobe, the main lobe, and so on. So with smart tuning of this double dual interferometer, that aircraft, the SR-70, would fly over any territory it wanted to the nearest 1 degree. It was measuring accurately the direction of arrival of all the signals of the interior, at the area it was flying over. And you looked at that record of exact angle of arrival to the nearest 1 degree as you fly a straight path alongside of somebody's territory. You can now locate every emitter on that piece of land to the nearest small fraction of a mile, and maybe even much better than that. So interferometry, particularly double dual interferometry, is a powerful tool for getting exact direction of arrival with very little ambiguity. But the philosophy of how it works is where all antenna patterns come from. Let me drop for one more comment on this. My very large parabolic dish antenna that might be 10 wavelengths in diameter might have a main lobe of 7 degrees of beam width. Those are real numbers. Where the hell is that coming from? Well, the outer edge of that parabolic dish on the far right-hand side and the outer edge of the parabolic dish on the far left-hand side, as you rotate the dish, the signal reflected from those two areas coming into the feed horn are going in phase and out of phase by an interferometry pattern. That's where the 7 degrees of beam width is coming from with a 10 wavelength diameter dish. So all antenna patterns, when you get down to the nitty gritty, really are interferometry. You study interferometry and you know the real baseline, the real bedrock of where antenna patterns come from. KC2WGB, K2RIW, ZECNET. You got it, John.
Very good, Dick. All right, so just to clear that up for me and this gentleman, even a single dish is experiencing interferometry in the way it's receiving as it's sweeping through. Is that correct?
Give that man a cigar. All antenna patterns, when you get down to the nitty-gritty, are sub-antenna interferometry. You take the little section of the dish on the two outer edges, compare that signal in amplitude and phase, and now you go the next step of the two portions of the dish, halfway to the outer on the right and halfway to the outer edge on the left, and you compare them as interferometry. You add that all together. We'll be deriving the antenna pattern step by step. All antenna patterns, in my opinion, at the sub-antenna level, are interferometry. That's where the antenna pattern comes from. You take all of your 10 and 20 year experience, antenna engineers, and you ask them the basic question. Hey, there's a beautiful antenna pattern on that polar plot. You just measured it. Where did that antenna pattern come from? It's likely to give you a great big equation. Says, I plug the numbers into this equation, that's where it comes from. That's not an answer. It's an answer, but it doesn't give you a warm, fuzzy feeling. All antenna telemetry. Ain't that crazy, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, from my point of view, it is, because when you think of a single antenna, that's not intuitive without understanding exactly what you're saying and explaining. Very good. Well, I'm sure that'll help him understand, and he can definitely go on the web and look up that, whether he wants to do it optically or RF, and he'll find a tremendous amount of information, as you know. All right, let me let her drop, and I'll go on to the next one.
And let me add a couple words here. Whether you're doing this interferometry measurement at 1 kilohertz, 1 megahertz, 1 gigahertz, or 10 to the 15 hertz, which is optical, it's the exact same electromagnetic spectrum. It is talking about higher or lower frequencies, bigger or shorter wavelengths. The physics is the same. That human eye you've got and its retina is a very sensitive sine wave detector, I could say, of the frequencies that the frequencies are so high that we measure it by wavelength because we can't count the hertz yet. In 1920, nobody had a 14 megacycle frequency counter. It didn't yet exist. In 1920, you found out that your electro wires said the wavelength between the nulls on your transmission line, on your electro wires, or on your slotted line, is 10 meters. And you know that the nulls are a half wavelength apart. Aha! My frequency must be the 20 meter band. We called it the 20 meter band because in those days you could only measure wavelength. You didn't have a frequency counter. Now that we got a frequency counter, we call it 14.1725 megahertz. That's a lot more accurate, so to speak, than measuring 20 point something something wavelengths. Well, we're still in the wavelength world when it comes to optical. And so 550 nanometers is the middle of the optical band. It's a green color, if you know what I mean. That's what your eye sees, green. And we measure it in wavelength because we ain't got a frequency counter up there yet. There's going to be a frequency counter up there. You just wait and see. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
Query.
That sounds like Bill. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, Dick. Just had a question about the dielectric properties of hot glue. Seems like a bad material to use on an antenna. What might be a better material? AC2IS.
If I took uncured Celastic adhesive, when its acid content is nice and conductive, and I put it on the end of my coax cable because I want to weatherproof it, this conductive material, while it's wet, is a pretty lousy material. When it fully cures, and it's now a nice, dry, rubbery material, it does a beautiful job of weatherproofing, and it's got a known dielectric constant with a fairly low loss tension, and it's a good material. There's a hell of a lot of glue-like materials that when they're wet, they're terrible, and when they're dry, they're great. A lot of materials fall into that. And if you dig deep enough into the manufacturer's spec, Bill, you'll find out that when it's dry, a lot of these things are really good. And to find something that'll give you weatherproofing of an antenna, for instance, means it's a pliable, wet material when you first apply it. And so you got to wait until it's cured in order to get the desirable characteristics downrange. And so you've got the wherewithal to find out the before and after of those situations, as I see it, Bill. Back to you, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, AC2IS here. I guess one question about this elastic adhesive, does it have a trade name? And also, hot glue is kind of convenient because it's rigid, and I was wondering if there was something else that was rigid. It sounds like this elastic adhesive is going to stay rubbery. AC2IS.
Amen. Yeah, John recognized hot glue, I think, could be pretty good. And, you have the ability, John, Bill, to measure its loss tension. You can take a good-sized blob of your hot glue, at least you can make the measurement very conveniently at 2450 megahertz. You put a nice large glob of it on a piece of foam, low dielectric foam, in your microwave oven with a glass of water. Run the microwave oven full blast, 700 watts, for 60 seconds. Then go in there and you'll find out the glass of water is very hot. And if that glue is cold, it's beautiful stuff, at least at 2450 megacycles. A damn good tester. You have the ability to measure the loss tangent of all these materials. I did that at a consulting firm I was working with, a client, well, I guess I did that 5 years ago, and I found out this very exotic piece of injection moldable rubber, which was called Dynaflex. Let me drop it. And this high-class company in Philadelphia, wish I could think of the name of the company, made this beautiful stuff, and it's guaranteed and its dielectric constant up. Its electrical characteristics were guaranteed up to and including 60 hertz. And I was about to use it at 915 megs, where they hadn't the vaguest idea what it would do way up there. In the microwave oven, it ran ice cold, and that became the injection moldable material around the antennas that got manufactured in the thousands. So this mysterious material that no one knew was good, I had measured it in the microwave oven and found out it was fantastic. So there's a lot of materials that, and by the way, this injection moldable rubber was black, deep black in color. Black as the ace of spades, as coal. Ordinarily, black materials look like absorbers. This stuff was ice cold, beautiful. KC2WGB, K2IOW, but you made measurements like that, John.
Yeah, this is AC2IS. So I did not do the microwave test on hot glue myself, but I did see a YouTube video where somebody put hot glue in a microwave oven without water. And the hot glue sticks did melt. That made me think that it was not going to work well, EC2IS.
Yeah, I'll turn it over to John in a minute. That's why I was turning it over to you right then. You put anything in a microwave oven with no load, you get an extremely phony test. Certain kinds of glass that's used for, say, for instance, a beer bottle, as a dielectric material, could be fantastic. You use it as the insulator at the base of your quarter-wave ground plane vertical antenna. That beer bottle could be the most beautiful dielectric material in the world. You put that beer bottle in a microwave oven with no glass of water, and because of the extreme hot spots, the Q of 10,000 inside that microwave oven, even though you're putting only 700 watts into it, at the hot spot where the glass bottle is at, it thinks it's seeing a megawatt. And the glass will start going on fire and sizzling and melting and doing all kinds of nasty things. You use a microwave oven without a standard load of a glass of water, you'll get a dramatic test. It's a loud noise that means nothing, if you know what I mean. Without a standard load, you're not doing a real test because you haven't defined what the peak of energy is in the hotspots. They go to infinity without a dummy load. So, John, KC2WG, I'm really turning it over to John. John, tell me what you've done along these lines. K2RW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick. If you know the silicones that are available, come in different colors and different substances, but they are entrained with acetic acid, and you can smell it. And they are conductive, but the best one to use and the most rigid is the RTV compound, which are up to 50,000 volts. Now, if you want to decrease the rigidity, you must use some kind of a sleeve, whether it be, you know, a piece of fiberglass or whatever type of, even a pen tube. I've used a ballpoint pen out, use that as a tube, loaded with RTV, great connection, and the rigidity is supported with the plastic. So it is doable. But hot glue, I'm not familiar with using that. And I don't know what the composition is, but I don't think that's a good thing to use on RF stuff, in my opinion. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, you can't be sure, John. There's times when it fools you. There was one guy named Tim Austin, a genius of a guy in plastic-like materials, rubbery-like materials, elastomer materials, who worked for a company called Symbol Technology. He knew what the long chain molecule looked like at the atomic level. He's the one guy I knew that 95% of the time could predict what the loss tangent was going to be when I went and measured it. And some of the rubbery-like materials, beautiful, clear-looking material, you would think it would be very low in loss, and ran hot as all hell in the microwave oven. And this black-looking stuff, injection-moldable rubber, which was called Dynaflex, was beautiful radio-wise. You can't tell by appearance. So there may be more than one brand of hot glue, and some of them may be very good, and some of them may be terrible. You can find out by the measurement we just indicated. And when it comes to Celastic adhesive, self-curing rubbery-like materials, you go to the GE or Monsanto, whoever manufactures them. At the industrial grade level, they probably have 15 different model numbers you can buy. Each one of them has, let me drop it. Each one of them has a different cure time, cured strength, dielectric strength, lost tangent, and whatever. And even if the manufacturer of your particular material only tells you what it will do at 60 hertz, and you're using it at 915 or 5.8 gigahertz, don't let that shock you into submission. You have the ability to make the measurement. Your measurement is not exactly traceable to the bureau with 1% accuracy. It doesn't have to be. You want to know that under your condition, it's going to absorb less than 1% of your RF energy, you're home free. If you find out the material is a fantastic dummy load, that's also a very valuable piece of information. You can literally make dummy loads out of it. Depending on what you're doing, a piece of dowel, a 3/4 inch diameter dowel, sharpened to a sharp point, put down a piece of 3/4 inch copper tubing that you're using for circular waveguide at 10 gigahertz, the moisture in that piece of wood makes an extremely good dummy load because it's a nice tapered material that's got a little bit of moisture in it. And you can get a reflection coefficient out of that of minus 30 dB. And I've done that. Who would ever think a wooden dowel out of Home Depot is a good dummy load? If you're smart enough, it is. So is a chunk of rubber tire from your bicycle. If you cut it to the right shape and put it in the waveguide just right, it makes a beautiful dummy load. So, is material, and water is the lossiest material in the world until you freeze it. Frozen ice water is an extremely good dielectric material. That's opposite of common sense. That's why that ice cube in your microwave oven does nothing alongside of that glass of water. Over to you, Bill. AC2IS, K2IW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, this is AC2IS. I'm just looking up something on Wikipedia about hot melt adhesive, and apparently it can be made either from a combination of things, or there are several options, either or options. One of the things is called EVA or ethylene vinyl acetate, and Wikipedia has to say about that that its dielectric properties are poor. And dielectric loss is quote unquote moderate high. I'm not sure what moderately high means. HOIS.
Yeah, no matter what they tell you, you can measure it. And even if you're using a lossy material, if the way you're using it is a thin enough level in wavelength, you can use lossy material as a radome over an antenna. But because you've made it, a 16th of an inch thick, which is a 1,000th of a wavelength at your operating frequency, the so-called thin skin design of a radome can be extremely good as making it a radome on the nose of an airplane. It can survive the rain erosion and the high velocity wind, and because there's so little of it in wavelength, the total amount of insertion loss you get could be extremely small. So even though you're using a lossy material, if you're crafty enough in the way you use it, the loss can be low. Conversely, you can be using a medium good quality material, and if you use a big blob of it in a high voltage point on the circuit, you can make it a very big loss even though you don't want it to be. So there's a lot of variables involved. Loss tangent is a complicated function, not always easy to predict if your name is not Tim Austin, so the best thing you can do is go and measure it in your microwave oven. And making a measurement at 2450, even though you intend to use it at 30 megacycles, it is a strong indication of what is the real loss tangent. So when you make those measurements on various kinds of hot glue, which I think you're going to do, Bill, please come back and let us know what you find. It's going to be valuable information. AC2IS from that scientific group in Cold Spring Harbor, K2IW. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, thanks. In this case, it would be kind of a sizable blob of hot glue that would, I guess, up to maybe a 16th of the wavelength involved. to hold elements in place. But yeah, okay, I'll see what testing I can do. This is AC2IS, I'll be on the side.
And Bill, do you intend to, later on in this TechNet or a later TechNet, bring us a little bit up to speed on what Jeremy, I think it is, KD2IJD, one of the guys in your group, what he has done with the beautiful looking antennas he's been building? Are you going to be bringing that to our attention in the near future? It's your choice. Over to you, Bill.
AC2IS here. Actually, it was last Wednesday. Jesse was playing. He built his homebrew SWR meter. He bought a directional coupler, which I think was the right move. I think he got one for about $40. And he's been making good measurements on those. He made a batch of 10 antennas, and I think out of the batch of 10, three of them he was very happy with the performance on, and the other seven he thought they were garbage. So one of those he let me play with it to see if I could sort of bend it into shape that it would break before it would bend, and if my attempts to bend it are any indication, he was right. The antenna broke right away. So he's trying to come up with ways to properly form to a high degree of accuracy his antennas before he puts the plastic dip coating on them and so forth. And Wednesday, I think I handed off that broken antenna to Chris to deliver to you. I'm not sure if you got a chance to see it. AC2IS.
That broken antenna is in my hand right now as we speak. And by the way, buying a directional coupler to make standing wave ratio measurements is an extremely good move, but the next step is to calibrate your directional coupler. What is its coupling coefficient? That you already know, it's on the label. But what is its true directivity? By way of the article by K2LIW that's on either the Mic 1 or Mic 2 website, where it's entitled something like directional couplers used for VisWow and power measurement, there's a whole calibration procedure in there that when you read it and understand it, you'll be able to get more and more accuracy out of your directional coupler, even if it's brand X, if you know what I mean. So there's ways you can use a directional coupler, and with a little bit of smarts, some of which is in that article, you can make measurements traceable to the Bureau of Standards. Let me drop. Now, the overall reason I think you guys are doing this 5.6, 5.8 gigahertz antenna design exercise is to have nearly circular polarization omnidirectional out to the horizon from these quadcopters that you guys are doing with the very precision, high-speed flying through mazes and things like that. And you want to get a good visual downlink. And you think you want an antenna of high-performance circular polarization omnidirectional pattern. That may or may not be true. If the system of reception has enough fade margin, I'm going to explain what that means. Let me drop. In other words, if your video downlink is radiating the right amount of power, and if the receiving signals and the receiving antennas you use into those receivers have enough sensitivity so that you had, let me pick a number, a 50 decibel fade margin, maybe 100 milliwatts and 100 feet of distance with the right antennas will dual that for you. If you had 50 dB of phase margin, the antenna you use could be a little bitty whip antenna made out of a piece of coaxial cable with a center conductor with its insulation is simply exposed as a quarter wave ground plane, so to speak, without a counterpoise. A yucky antenna, pure vertical polarization, waving in the breeze. And every time you crash, that piece of flexible cable simply bends and doesn't break, even though it doesn't have ideal polarization and antenna pattern. Because you have 50 dB or 40 dB of fade margin, in my example, and no matter how you orient that aircraft, you're never going to get a null 40 dB down. Therefore, you always have coverage if you have the right fade margin. So, under the right circumstances, a really yucky antenna can be more than adequate, and it doesn't have to be this exotic antenna with the ideal antenna pattern, that has this slight vulnerability that when you crash the aircraft, the antenna becomes damaged. There's another whole approach there, Bill, worth considering. AC2IS, K2RIW in the TechNet. You guys are under a good plan here.
This is AC2IS, and I believe Jesse is listening. He's, I think, mobile on an HT right now. If you call out to him, I think there's a good chance he would come back, AC2IS.
Yeah, we're all falling into the problem of the Roxxon and Bux, and these inexpensive radios have slightly narrow audio, modulation width. Kilo Delta 2, India Juliet Delta. If you're there, Jesse, give us a few words. K2LIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yes, hello. Can you hear me? Yeah, I'm listening.
Yeah, I think you're on a handy talkie, and as you move, you go into and out of the signal into the repeater. We only heard you 40% of the time, and you said you are listening, so I don't think we're going to get solid enough copy, Jesse, to hold a QSO with you. If you, at some future time, make the simplest of all coat hanger wire antennas and hang it at a high altitude somewhere in your house, run a piece of RG58 cable down to your operating position, and with the right adapters, you plug it into that handy talkie of yours. Because of the extra altitude and a fixed position, your signal can easily be 20 decibels stronger to us all the time. That's the equivalent of raising your power by 100 to 1. So by adding the right antenna to your handy talkie when you want to talk to the TechNet, you'll suddenly be a hell of a lot better sounding. Bill, AC2IS, went through a similar exercise. He used to give us rather weak signals. You'll notice he's giving us dead full quieting signals these days. Well, what antenna change did you make to make that happen, Bill? AC2IS, K2RIW in the TechNet?
This is AC2IS. Jesse reports that he's in Long Island City and on the LIE driving east, so maybe he'll come into better range at some point. Before I was using a Waxon handheld to transmit, and now I'm using a mobile radio at 50 watts plus a mag mount antenna, which I used to have on my car, and right now is stuck on a side panel for an old computer case, just so I can have something magnetic to stick to and be a decent ground plane. So I don't know what percentage of the improvement to attribute to the higher power on the radio and how much to the better mag mount antenna, but those are the changes that were made in the AC2IS.
Both of those, Bill, were a strong improvement in the right direction, and it's only academic how much each one is doing it. In the case of Jesse, if he's willing to use a mag mount antenna on his automobile, cable coming into the handy talkie, that also will make him 20 decibels stronger, the equivalent of raising his power 100 to 1. VHF antennas, what makes them work well? Three things. Location, location, location. Call it altitude, 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 if you know what I mean. The difference between a rubber duck antenna inside of an automobile versus a mag mount on the roof can be a huge improvement. The difference between a mag mount in your hand, I mean a rubber duck handy talkie in your hand versus connected to a cable, even a lossy cable that goes up to the attic or the chimney of the house, can make a huge improvement. So VHF needs altitude to climb above the trees, to climb above the terrain, to climb above the obstacles, to give us good signals in the repeater. So in time, Jesse's going to be getting louder and louder, I predict, just like you did, Eric. I mean, there we go. Bill, I know we've interrupted the flow of the mailbag, John, and you can get back to it if you like. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
No problem, Dick. Yeah, it's all good information. Okay, by the way, a gentleman in Miami just sent over a message. That's KF4T, and he supports the same website that Eric had pointed out. out. Excellent website, a lot of information on oscilloscopes and other equipment on there, so it's worth visiting. Thought I'd drop that by in case anybody was listening. KT2WGB. All right, we'll pick up this next question. It's the last one. I think we spoke about a week ago about this gentleman who asked this question. Looking at vertical antennas, quarter wave, half wave, 5/8, and so on, can understand the quarter wave and the half wave becoming resonant, but how does 5/8 work out? When you look at the wave at the 5/8 point, how does that become resonant? So maybe you could explain that to him, Dick, how that works out and what is needed to that resonance. Back to you, KC2WGB.
One of the hard things to believe is that the length of the antenna in wavelengths can be anything you like. Anything from, let me pick a number, a tenth of a wavelength to 10 wavelengths long. As you change the length of the antenna, the impedance you see, depending on how you feed it, it's going to be going up and down, left and right, all over the place. It almost doesn't matter. If you're smart enough to impedance match the antenna, which forces it into resonance and forces it to act like maybe a 50 ohm load to your particular transmission line, under those conditions, all the power you generate goes into that antenna and gets radiated. As you change the length of a quarter wave ground plane like antenna, going from quarter wave to half wave to 5/8, you'll see that the amount of signal on the horizon keeps getting stronger up to 5/8. As you go longer than 5/8, the signal on the horizon starts going down, you're developing lobes at other altitudes. Let me drop. An antenna that's a resonant length, a half wave long, is a pure resistor. You make it longer than a half wave long, it's an inductor. And if you put the right kind of a loading coil-like mechanism, resonator, at the base of the antenna, you take any of these commercially made 5/8 wave mag mount-like antennas, and you look in the base of an antenna, you're going to see a spiral coil with taps on it where the input coax cable goes to one point and the center of the coil goes to the radiator. That forces that 5/8 wave to go all the way up to 3/4 of a wave, where it goes into resonance again. Electronically, it's 3/4 of a wavelength long. Physically, it's 5/8 of a wavelength long. The physical length of the radiator is what determines the antenna pattern. As you add impedance matching devices to an antenna, you have no change in the antenna pattern. You're only changing the impedance match. What impedance your transmission line and transmitter and antenna tuner is going to see. So you can use any length of wire as the radiator if you're smart enough. You can force every one of them to be in resonance if you add the right reactor. You can force every one of them to be whatever resistive number you want, 1 ohm, 50 ohms, 100 ohms, 1,000 ohms, by what you do with the network, sometimes an L network, sometimes a pi network, like your antenna tuner, whatever you put between the transmission line and the antenna, you can step up to step down the impedance any way you want. If you've used quality components, let me drop. If you use quality components, all of that impedance matching and resonating can be done with near 100% efficiency. So, for traditional reasons, we think a half-wave dipole at 95% velocity factor has to be a very specific physical length to work. For traditional reasons, 90-some-odd percent of the ham radio operators and electronic engineers believe that. And they think also it's got to be horizontal, parallel to the ground, straight out, fed in the center. For traditional reasons, that's the way it's done 98% of the time. Doesn't have to be that way. You can feed the outer edge. You can make it longer, shorter. You can bend it in various ways. If you're smart enough in what you add to it for the impedance matching network, right at the beginning of the antenna, if you like, you can make it any length, make it resonate. You resonate first, then it has the ability to radiate. Because all radiation means that inside of the antenna, the signal is bouncing back and forth at least 10 times or more before it finally gets radiated. What you and I call resonance is making sure all of those bounces stay in step with each other, stay co-phase, so that the current gets magnified, so that the local magnetic field gets stronger, so it radiates. Radiation is hard. You have to kick that signal on your antenna in the tail 10 times in a row before it finally leaves the antenna everything gets radiated in space. And the only way you can do that is to resonate it. Those magic words are not in any respected text that I know of on the subject of antennas. It's the most basic concept that every antenna engineer, whether he knows it or not, is doing it day in and day out when he's building and designing antennas. You guys got the secret. Make sure you don't tell anybody. KC2WCB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Just let it drop? Okay. Very good, Dick. I know people have heard the explanation many times, but this gentleman, youngster, asked the question from a different viewpoint, and that's why I asked it. I know the answer's been given many times, but it sure helps understand why when you cut a quarter wave, you don't need anything, you can make it match. But when you go into those other odd lanes, there you go with the matching requirement. Okay, that's it from the mailbag. Very good night. And pick it up with Paul. I'm sure he's got a lot of interesting information for us. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, John. I'm trying to remember the last time I wrote it down. When did I write it? There it is, 134 astronomic units. My favorite spacecraft, Voyager, launched, I think, 1977, a zillion years ago. It's out there three times the distance of Pluto, something like 8 billion miles, 134 astronomical units. It's out there transmitting about 6 watts of power, and when NASA wants to, it talks to us saying, hey, Goldstone, here I am. This is what I'm seeing right now. This is how the conditions are out here as I travel at 40,000 miles away from you guys, away from the sun, away from the Earth, going out there into the Kuiper Belt and the Oort Cloud. That is the most distant piece of electronics that mankind has ever issued, and it's continued to break records. And I think Paul has told us that right now they have reason to believe they're going to continue talking to that thing until the year 2022 or maybe beyond. Ain't that crazy? Nobody would have believed that when that thing was launched in 1977. I'll bet you the definition of success in those days that it should keep operating for 5 years or something like that.
You know, Dick, we were half our age when that was launched. Just think about that, and it's still working. Isn't that amazing?
Who would ever think that that would take place? Ain't heard, ain't heard nothing yet. So what else is NASA doing that's interesting these days, Paul? WS2N, with what I think is going to be space report number 187 of the series. K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul. And give us a brief transmission to make sure we hear you well tonight.
Okay, very good. This is WS2N. And for the brief transmission, I'll give you a more amazing statistic. The head project manager for that Voyager program is Ed Stone. He's still at it after all these decades. How's the transmission, Dick?
You're 95% audio, 5% hiss. You sound good. Please proceed.
Quick question for Paul before he starts, Dick.
You've got it, John.
Paul, quick question is, did you hear about the moving hills on Pluto? Did you catch that article in the Science News? If you have information on it. Back to you, Dick.
It's all yours, Paul.
I did read it. It came up on quite a few websites, including the Pluto app that I've had. But, you know, what they're trying to get at is, you know, when they said floating, I think it's just moving on, you know, on the surface. There's a lot of ice there, frozen nitrogen. So who knows what it's moving on. And the point is, that how did it get there? Is it something that came up from under the ground and just sitting there? And they're investigating, John. That's pretty much what you read. It comes from the southeast corner of that heart. Remember, everything was, you know, it was shaped like a heart when they first took a picture of Pluto from the New Horizons.
Yes, Paul, that's what I read, and it seems to be that they are dealing with water, which is frozen, on top of maybe methane or some other gas, and that is allowing it to be fluid because of the pressure, and for some reason it's moving, and they were just mystified.